Case the court will call in here is the case of Donnie Ray Exline Sr. in Commonwealth of Virginia. You may begin.
And may I reserve 5 minutes?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Mark Bailey on behalf of Donnie Ray Exline Sr. Where it appears probable that the defendant has been substantially prejudiced by an improper argument, and the trial court has failed to take corrective action, an appellate court must remove the prejudice by ordering a new trial. That is the issue here before the court.
Why wasn't there waiver by waiting until the end of argument to raise the issue?
Well, I would ask the court if it was to look at the record. The court can see that it was at the very tail end of the argument that the comments were made. I would suggest all of the issues out of this case come between approximately 3 pages in the record. Those are the very tail end. And as far as the Commonwealth's argument that the issue is not preserved, I was trial counsel. I was there at the trial, and when I did make the motion, attempted to make the motion, I was told to sit down and wait.
But that you had waited, and I understand. I gather it was out of courtesy to the other side, so as to not interrupt them. But you did not interrupt. It was not a contemporaneous objection.
Well, I would post to the court that although it wasn't made exactly when the words came out of the prosecutor's mouth, there was definitely time for the court to take corrective action. The court could have instructed the jury to disregard those comments. There could have been a cautionary instruction given by the judge. No action was taken by the court at that point. Under Taylor versus Commonwealth, it is always the duty of the court at the proper time to instruct the jury on all principles of law applicable to the pleadings and evidence. The trial court at that point has an obligation. And as the record shows, when I did attempt to make that motion, I was not permitted to at that time. Otherwise, the court could have held the jury before allowing them to deliberate. As stated in the in my brief, the primary function of Rule 5A18 is to alert the trial judge to the possible error so that some corrective action could be taken. And that is what I attempted to do at the close of that argument before the jury had been sent out to deliberate. The Commonwealth, in their brief, tries to compare this particular instance with the recently decided case of Maxwell and Roe versus Commonwealth. But I would tell the court that the more applicable portion of that, which would grow, does not mirror the case at hand. In Roe, the counsel asked to make a motion outside the presence of the jury, and he invited the delay. He was then given a chance to respond again to the court and was given the opportunity to essentially speak. And when he was given that opportunity, the court said, "We'll deal with it when the jury goes out to retire." The counsel had an opportunity to respond very well. He did acquiesce in that delay.
Can you tell us, based upon your assessment of Maxwell and Roe, why those two cases are different and were decided different?
Well, Roe, I think, as I was just stating to the court, was decided because there was that permitted delay by counsel. Counsel allowed that delay to happen until the jury went out to deliberate, and at that point, they decided that because of his own actions, that he permitted the delay. Maxwell, I believe, was not similar to the case at hand. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the factual issue of Maxwell at the moment.
Yeah, Maxwell was the one where the trial judge actually gave the jury some instructions without counsel being present.
That would be a very different situation than the one that we
have. Same judge in your case.
Same judge.
Yeah.
Yes. that one the council did not have the opportunity, was not even present at that time. But and as I argued at the three judge panel hearing, that when I was told to sit down and wait, that was not a suggestion, it was an order.
Like when my mother used to put the vegetables in front of me, saying, I'm not asking you to eat those vegetables, I'm telling you that you are going to eat those vegetables.
And that brings me to another point that the Commonwealth raised in its brief, is that all of the possibilities of what I could have done as counsel at the time, I could have politely addressed the court again, I could have interrupted the court again, but I was told by the court to sit down and wait after the court knew that I had something important to tell it, and I at that point did not feel that I was under any obligation in order to preserve the record to then interrupt him again, knowing that the possible detriment would lie against my client as well as myself. When I did look to the principles of professionalism that's posted on the Virginia Bar website, as well as in the court lobby entering the courtroom that we had this trial in, I'll tell you that when I looked through that, more than anything that I see repeated in here is respect and courtesy. And I understand that the system that we are in is an adversarial system, but when the trial court instructs you to do something, the trial judge instructs you to do something, does not give you the opportunity to then reply, I try to exercise respect and courtesy to the trial judge. And I believe that my attempt in trying to address the court with that motion was preserved, should be preserved, and I don't think that it should be a precedent being set that we must interrupt the judge not once, but twice or three times. How many times must we interrupt the presiding judge in order for it to be preserved on record? As far as, I'll move along to the substance of my issues on appeal, and that would be the prosecutor's comments. Those of burden shifting and also a misstatement of the law regarding the area of constructive possession. The Commonwealth did make comments that detrimented my client's right to a fair and impartial trial. Those comments essentially told the jury that he had an obligation to produce some sort of evidence to prove his innocence. The court has been no more than clear over and over and over again that the Commonwealth is the only party that bears a burden. The defendant doesn't have to bear a burden. And when the trial judge basically commented that it was fair argument because it's fair to either side and that there is no difference between Commonwealth argument and defense argument, I disagree with that. I believe that the Commonwealth still has that burden and that there was not an invited error on this part. Prosecutor had the ability to argue against my argument that they did not produce certain evidence by stating that they didn't have to produce that evidence. They could have simply left it at that. They could have argued that we've carried our burden beyond a reasonable doubt based on what you've heard, not what you haven't heard. But what they did was they took it one step too far and infringed upon my client's constitutional rights by implying that he had to produce some sort of evidence.
But the suggestion is that based upon your theory of argument in closing, you essentially opened the door for that discussion or reference that the Commonwealth made in rebuttal. What would be your response to that?
Well, if the door was open, I think I still would argue that the Commonwealth has a duty not to cross a line there, which it did.
Where's the line?
The line. As I was trying to convey just a minute ago, that the prosecutor could argue that if they don't have to produce any evidence of DNA fingerprints, as she did argue. But when she crossed that line and when she started saying, but he didn't carry his burden, he didn't produce any evidence, that crossed the line. That was not invited error, but that was simply inappropriate comments and argument. And there had been no instruction, no evidence that he had the ability to produce that evidence as well. This was argument from the prosecutor that went too far and without basis.
Wasn't the jury instructed on the appropriate burden of proof that the Commonwealth was required to follow?
And that the defendant didn't have to testify?
Yes. The jury was instructed on that, and these comments came after the jury had been instructed on that. These comments came in the final rebuttal closing argument of Commonwealth, and the judge did not make any or take any action at that point to say, you know, jury, they've misstated, or the, just to remind you, as many other cases that I looked into, the judge would take that time and say, counsel, 1 minute, just to remind the jury, the defendant does not have any burden of proof, no burden of proof whatsoever.
Obviously, that would have been the better practice. But according to the Gaines case, and of course there's a whole line of cases, that's just one that I'll mention, it is presumed that the jury has followed the instructions that have been given to it, is it not?
It's presumed that they can follow the instructions that are given. But I will refer back to that quote where it is always the duty of the court at the proper time to instruct the jury of all principles of law applicable to the pleadings and evidence. That would have been the easiest corrective action for the trial court to take at that point in order to rectify the situation, possibly a cautionary instruction as well. But the court did not do that. The court not only sent the jury out without correcting them, but then on the record basically confirmed that he believed that the Commonwealth was fine in their comments. And there are also the, because this was a issue regarding my client's constitutional rights, I would hold that it was not harmless error, and it has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not harmless error on the part of the Commonwealth. If we look to the facts and the determination by the jury, my client was charged with two different offenses, one of being a felon in possession of the firearm, the second, shooting that firearm from a vehicle. What the case came down to was the credibility of the son who was in the car and the father who was in the car. I represent the father. DJ was the son. And the son's testimony was that he didn't hold the rifle, he didn't shoot the rifle during that period, it was all the father. Father's testimony was just the opposite. They found my client not guilty of shooting that firearm, which means that they did have some question about the credibility of their star witness. They didn't believe him. So as to whether or not the improper comments weighed upon the jury and remained in their minds and affected their verdict, I would say it certainly did. Because part of the Commonwealth's argument was that, one, he didn't produce evidence. He could have showed you that he was innocent. Two, the fact that he was in the car with the gun is enough that you must find him guilty. And that is clearly not the law.
Counsel, I'm just pointing out you are in your rebuttal time. You can use it as you choose, but I did want to make you aware of that.
I'll stop.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth's main position in this case is that both of these sons of error have been procedurally defaulted because the appellant did not raise his motion for mistrial until after the jury had left to go deliberate.
Do you agree that the rebuttal comments of the Commonwealth were not appropriate?
I would not agree to that, no, Your Honor. I could get to that now if you'd like.
Either way, however you would like to handle it.
Well, let me just talk about why I think the issue has not been preserved. Certainly the second assignment of error has not been preserved because it was raised after trial. There was no contemporaneous objection to that.
Counsel, I appreciate what you said in your brief about you do not expect your opponent colleague to be discourteous to the court or not an officer of the court, but aren't we putting lawyers in a real tough spot when they make an objection, which may well be a valid objection, and at the time that objection is made, it's contemporaneous and it's timely and all of that. And the judge says, sit down. And the lawyer has a Hobson's choice at that point, or maybe even a dilemma. I can either keep running my mouth and run the risk of going to jail myself, or I can sit down and try to figure out a way to preserve the record. I think your opponent and colleague, bless you, chose the second recourse, saying, you know, I'm going to just, I tried to stand up, I tried to make the judge aware, he's told me to sit down, I'm going to sit down, but as soon as I get a chance and he's going to let me speak, I'm going to speak. Where does that leave a lawyer?
I mean, I have a few responses to that. I do think that you can't say pass the buck, because the Supreme Court of Virginia has said this has to be done before the jury leaves. And you could say, Your Honor, I'm sorry, but the Supreme Court of Virginia said I have to make this objection now. That's one thing he could have done. He could have asked for a bench conference just to not to, to look bad in front of the jury, if that's, that's the concern. But in this case, even if you take, even if his actions were fine, if he sat down, he waited, at that point the judge, he's instructing the jury on their final instructions before they leave out. After the judge is done, I would submit that there is an opportunity there for him to stand up and make his objection known to the court and say, listen, Your Honor, before the jury leaves, I have an important motion for mistrial. So, because once they're gone, he can't, according to the case law, Chang and Roe, that's too late. So, even if what he did is fine, and, you know, in hindsight, it's easy to second guess it, and I'm certainly, I don't know the trial judge, and I did not know this was the trial judge from Maxwell until this morning. And I still think there is an opportunity there to make his objection known, and he did not. And unfortunately, that did not happen. Basically, for those two reasons, we would argue that these issues have not been preserved, and that this case should be decided under 5A18. Assuming that the court would want to reach one or both of these issues, it's also our Commonwealth's position that neither of these arguments were improper. I'll begin with the first issue, and I think it's important to recognize that the defendant actually did testify in this case. So we're not talking about a Fifth Amendment violation against self-incrimination. I think that's important to recognize that he actually testified. And what he testified to was, my fingerprints and my DNA would not be on that firearm. And then in closing, the defense counsel repeatedly relied upon the fact that he said, not only said that they continually took the Commonwealth to task for not having the firearm sent off for forensic testing. And then only in rebuttal is when the Commonwealth responded to the defense's repeated argument that they should have had this firearm tested for fingerprints and DNA, that they, and the portion I think that the counsel says that's gone too far is when the Commonwealth said that the defendant did not send this off to the lab, did not ask for it to be tested, and didn't show that his fingerprints or DNA wasn't on it. And it's the Commonwealth's position that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in determining that this was a fair argument. What the Commonwealth, what she, the prosecutor, is simply saying is this, we did not have to send it to this firearm off for DNA testing. It's a non-issue. We are just simply saying you cannot rely upon that fact. They didn't ask for it to be tested. They didn't send it off either. And the defendant has said his DNA is not on it, or his fingerprints are not on it. He has not. There's nothing to say that there's no evidence of that. And I don't think what the Commonwealth is doing is shifting the burden there. I think it's a proper argument, and I would cite to the Polino case, which talks about a failure or neglect of an accused to produce evidence that's within his power may be considered by a fact finder, as opposed to a statement that the defendant had a burden to produce evidence. I'd also say, even if the Commonwealth did arguably cross some sort of line here, I think the doctrine of invited error would apply in this case simply because of how the defense laid out their closing argument. I think the Commonwealth was simply making a fair argument in response to what the defense had argued.
I'm trying to remember, during the evidence, wasn't it through cross-examination that the defendant was saying that, no, you would not find my fingerprints or DNA on it?
I believe, Your Honor, that is during direct examination. Mm-hmm. And I can point to page, perhaps. It was page 220 and 221 of the appendix. And I believe that is during direct examination. That is. As simply to the second issue, I think the appellant is mischaracterizing the Commonwealth's closing. I don't think that the Commonwealth was misstating the law of constructive possession there. I think the Commonwealth painstakingly focused on the defendant's acts and statements and conduct and why that this case is a constructive possession case. I would also take issue with that the fact that the jury acquitted the defendant of the shooting of the vehicle statute does not mean that they didn't believe he still shot the gun. If you look at that statute, it says, any person while in a motor vehicle intentionally discharges a firearm so as to create a risk of injury or death to another person, and it goes on and on. What very well could have happened is that the jury could have believed that he did shoot this gun, but the fact that he was out in this field where there was no one around, essentially, it was just the Commonwealth tried to rely on the fact there was a couple houses around. They could have just said, well, he was just shooting at some deer, there's no risk of injury or death. I don't think that you can accurately say that they just did not believe the son's testimony based on the fact that he was not convicted of that particular charge. If the court has any other questions, I would just ask it.
Thank you, counsel.
Just addressing some of the concerns that Commonwealth brought up at this point. Although Mr. Exline did testify in this matter, the comments made by the Commonwealth were inappropriate and did impart on him the burden to produce evidence. Similar to the case Hartigan versus Commonwealth, and I believe that is in Hartigan, I'll try to find the site, but Hartigan was the case where the defendant was accused of stealing videotapes. And at the time, during the trial, there was evidence, the Commonwealth brought in evidence or made a comment that the defendant did not produce receipts for those videotapes. That was found to violate the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights, as well as the similar rights under the Virginia Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And I believe that's similar here. Again, the Commonwealth is held to a burden, and the only burden in the case lies on the Commonwealth, and that to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Benham is never required to produce any evidence to prove his innocence.
But there are cases, and you talked about some of them, but some of the most interesting language comes from a case quoting the Lincoln case. It says, a remark by a prosecutor, otherwise improper, may become proper under the invited error doctrine when the area has been open to fair comment by the argument and comment of defense counsel. It's clear that this issue that is so important was made subject to comment by you on your client's behalf. Why wouldn't it be fair under the Lincoln case to
consider that.
Well, as I stated earlier, the I'm not saying that the Commonwealth could not comment on my argument or comment on the evidence.
You're saying that the way that they commented was inappropriate.
The way that they did take it too far. They could have said, Mr. Bailey, he's saying that everything relies on this evidence that wasn't brought here today. Well, we don't have to refer to any of that evidence because that's not part of our burden. She had the opportunity to do that, but when she did impose that burden on my client that he didn't do something, he didn't come here today and produce a witness saying that he didn't do it. He didn't come here today with fingerprints. That's where they crossed the line and offended his right to a fair trial.
Okay. Your time has expired. I'll give you 30 seconds to sum up.
Yes. I will just leave with the quote that the Virginia Supreme Court has not hesitated to reverse cases in which it appears the Commonwealth attorney made prejudicial arguments. And I would ask the court to please reverse and remand or dismiss.
All right.